And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And welcome to the VanCast, Farhan Lalji and Thomas Dranson. Before we continue to break down the latest with the Vancouver Canucks and their preseason, who's coming, who's going, we do want to recognize the fact that this is the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. And for myself, I'm broadcasting on the territorial grounds of the Sumas and Matsqui First Nations. And Tom, it's really important that collectively we all recognize what was a very difficult part of this country's history that's been ignored for far too long, everything that went on with the residential schools and really where we were as a nation before we began as a nation.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important to do as the Canucks did on Monday and call it for what it is, genocide. Of course, I'm recording from the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations in Vancouver here. And, you know, I do hope that people are able to spend today reflecting on, you know, a dark and too often unacknowledged side of our country's history, you know, our role on this land as settlers, and what we can begin to do to chart a healing path forward for our entire country.
Yeah, and education and acknowledgement really is front and center in all of that, and really what we've gone through for the last few years as this country's come to an awakening, and then certainly now with the first ever national holiday for truth and reconciliation, I think it's a good time to reflect and continue in that process. And for us, we're going to talk about something far less important, and that's sports. But I'll tell you this as we segue, something far more important than the Vancouver Canucks, and that is, who is BC's team, Thomas Strance, when it comes to Major League Baseball? Because I submit to you and your Toronto background that it is the Seattle Mariners. Don't tell me who the better team is. Not interested.
No, I'm sure 1 in 5 people agree with you. I mean, this is a Blue Jays town. This is not a Mariners town.
Listen, see you with your Blue Jays. I see you with your Blue Jays hats when you come to the ring. But I'll tell you this. I grew up when it was more of a Mariner town than it was a Blue Jays town. And I'll say this. When I worked for the first time at TSN, and this was post-Blue Jays World Series titles, okay? The television ratings on Sportsnet, which at the time professed to be a regional network, and they actually cared about airing Mariner games. Now, they certainly didn't promote it because they were owned by Rogers and it was all about promoting the Blue Jays, but they did air Mariner games. Their television ratings back in the mid and late 90s were actually higher for Mariner games in this market than they were for Blue Jay games. Not significantly higher. It was close. They were in the same talking point, same discussion area, but this was a legitimate discussion. And I think it's difficult to have the discussion now.
A generation ago. Like, sure, are you telling me that the ratings for the team that had Ken Griffey Jr. and Randy Johnson and Edgar Martinez were good? No kidding. Alex Rodriguez, like one of the most stacked teams of the last 30 years. People wanted to watch them play baseball. Shocking.
But that's so what we're talking about is this is a baseball affinity. This is a baseball argument and a regional argument as much as it is a historical argument, right? So the truth
one
is
one of the
is
worst franchises.
Yes, all
of the
true.
Past 25 years.
All true.
Trash.
100%.
And no team has ever made the MLB postseason with a run differential as bad as the Mariners is right now. -48.
I am not here to debate to you at all.
It's not going to happen this week.
I'm not here to debate to you at all.
Why does anyone want to see a trash team and a trash mismanaged franchise be rewarded by like the gods of absolute fluky sports nonsense?
Because that is sport, and that's the best part about sport. And that team that first made the American League playoffs and their refused to lose that people in the Pacific Northwest remember so fondly, even with that stacked team, other than Ken Griffey Jr., we didn't know how stacked they were till they finally did it. Till there was a historical perspective on how good that team was. Yeah, they had Randy Johnson and they had A-Rod, a young A-Rod. But it took a team that captured that market and went on a historical run, much like this team is doing, winning 10 of their last 11 and having the best record in the American League since August 10th. That's fun. That's what sport is about. That's when we fall in love. That franchise was on the verge of moving from Seattle because nobody ever even contemplated a new stadium. But that team got people so excited about it that we have a fantastic stadium. And yes, it's sad what's happened to them and they've been awful. But everybody in that region has gone back on the bandwagon, even people that weren't. For me, I've always kind of side-eyed baseball because I have no interest in it generally, other than the fact that I hate the Toronto Blue Jays. But I always side-eye it, and now we're in September, and now I'm going to look at it with both eyes, and I'm going to hope that I can jump on the bandwagon. And when they're good, bad, or indifferent, if they get in and knock the Blue Jays out, hell yeah!
Well, you and the contrarian 20% of the city that just lives to loathe Toronto sports.
But you're talking about the contrarian part. Let's compare this as a real fair argument because you want to talk about what's in our history and what's in our blood. And if we hadn't been force-fed the Toronto agenda every time they remotely get into the playoffs, and we do because the coverage completely holds us hostage if you're into watching all sports television. Okay, it does. So it's a free commercial all the way through that the Seattle Mariners won't be fortunate enough to get. And you have to acknowledge that because that's real. And on top of that, it's been a bad team. It's been a bad team and a bad franchise. So if you make it an apples to apples argument, we have a chance to say the Seattle Mariners matter as much or more because we see how much we care about the Seattle Seahawks. But
no one cares about the Mariners because they're trash.
Yeah, but you're
missing
my point.
They've been trash for a long time.
So they've
people care about the Blue Jays, Farhan, because they've done an excellent job marketing in this region. And by the way,
because they're owned by the television station.
No, stop that.
They're owned by the television station. There's no stop that.
Stop taking credit away. Stop taking credit away from the excellent work of the Vancouver Canadiens organization over the last 10 years, building a really fun ballpark experience.
But they did before.
Deepening those ties.
Yeah, but I grew up at Nat Bailey, and whether the Oakland A's...
What are you talking about? The Nats sat half empty in 2009.
It was a great place to go in the summer. It was a AAA franchise.
And people didn't go.
That's not true.
I mean, there were times when they were the Angels affiliate.
It was a fantastic place to go to.
In the late 90s, when you had a point. But for 10 years between, you know, like the late 90s and the purchase by the Blue Jays, it was not what it has been and has become again over the last 12 years, Farhan.
Yeah, but we also like went through some ups and downs of the level of baseball they played at. You can't give full credit for all of this to the Vancouver Canadiens.
You can't also give full credit to this for like the propaganda machine. When a big part of it's that the Blue Jays have been super entertaining and have had a ton of key players that have Vancouver Canadiens ties be big contributors in huge moments. Things like you know, the bat flip, the wild card walk-off home run by Edwin. Like, the Blue Jays have had moments of resonance in this market, moments that were tied to the Vancouver sports scene. Like, the propaganda machine wouldn't matter if you were selling trash like you've seen in Seattle.
But you sold trash up until about 5 years ago in Toronto, right? Like, they got relevant again 5 to 6 years ago, but their run was horrific for a long period of time, to the point where even in their own market, people lost interest, much like you would expect them to do when they were trash. And I think you're totally overplaying the Vancouver Canadiens element of it.
No.
Because people don't follow player X all the way through. We don't have that many baseball fans in this market. Right,
like we don't have that many Mariners fans in this market, but there's a fair few Blue Jays fans. The Blue Jays also, this Blue Jays team, absolute juggernaut, going to be super relevant in an MLB context for years to come. This Mariners team, you know, the things they do well result in a PDO of 106. Like, who cares? Maybe they sneak in and get smoked by the Red Sox. They've got no real shot. I'm happy that the, you know, 200 really loud Mariners fans in this market get to stick their chest out for a team that's just absolutely garbage.
Best record in the American League since August 10th.
Let's not pretend there's any comparison, regardless of how this week turns out, between what they are and what the Blue Jays are. Not just in the hearts of fans in this market, but in terms of the actual quality of their team.
The hearts of Blue Jay fans in this market, they're much the same. They were nowhere to be found until 5 years ago. And then they decided to jump back on the bandwagon because it got relevant again.
As opposed to you and your Mariners support.
Yes, I'm guilty as charged. Guilty as charged. And that's the point.
I have no problem with bandwagon jumping, Farhan.
And that's what Toronto fans have done in the last 5 years, because for 15 years, they were equal trash. So, like, and you're totally overblaming the Canadians
always
do a great job.
Man.
So the Blue Jays, they're hidden, and now they'll come out because they're relevant again, and they're entertaining. And from a talent perspective, they're better. And look at the Seattle. They're like the youngest team in the American League right now. They are young, and they're going to get better. And I couldn't sit here and defend it because I don't know enough about baseball, and I don't give a damn. But for the amount that I will care, I'm all on Team Mariner.
Well, enjoy it. I mean, look, it's going to be a fun 3 days. And what's more fun than, you know, four teams in the mix, like the Yankees and the Red Sox, the two most public teams in the sport, and then the Mariners and the Blue Jays. This is, like, excellent for any Vancouver baseball fan. Like, this week is as good as it gets for Vancouver baseball fans. So enjoy it and talk trash and make fun of the fact that you have, like, two friends that pretend they're Mariner fans and have really just come out of the woodwork now calling you a bandwagon fan because you weren't, like, watching 80 Blue Jays games a year in 2013.
Were you really watching 80 Blue Jay games in 2013?
Oh, dude, I used to have the Toronto Star card when I was, like, in university all through. And it was, like, $120 for the year. And you could go to every game. It was like season's tickets, so long as the game wasn't sold out, which no game was ever sold out, except Canada Day, maybe opening day. And so,
because they were so bad.
I went to tons of Blue Jays games.
Well, you know what?
They were so
bad. As a guy that is so into numbers and analytics, like, baseball is meant for you, right? So that's, I totally appreciate your appreciation for it. For me, I used to cover it, right? So I used to actually, back then when I was your age, because that did happen at one point, I used to watch all the Mariner games. So, you know, like, I had a good buddy of mine that I coached football with, and we were big into it, right? So in the 90s and early 2000s, we collectively, after football practice, would go to Champs Pub in Burnaby and would watch games all the time. I could completely dial you through every nuance of roster and who did what back then. And I covered that team when I first got into the media. And I know that when they set the American League record, or the baseball record, with 116 wins, I was down there covering that team. It was an electric place to be. I still think Safeco, or whatever it is now. What is it called now?
Beautiful ballpark.
It's as good as any retro park still. So I was legitimately involved and invested back then. Not now, but happy to get on the bandwagon now. And anytime they're close, I'm all in. So
happy to have your heart broken.
With that, are we going to do a side bet on which team wins the wild card if they play each other, or which team gets in? Were we going to have a side bet?
There's no way the Blue Jays are playing the Mariners in the wild card.
Okay, so
the Mariners aren't making it.
So which team gets in? Are we going to have a bet? Are we having a side stake bet 2.0?
Yeah.
This is VanCast 2.0.
Like maybe like some locks, something Seattle themed. Like it got to be seafood themed, right?
All right. I'm not a big seafood guy, but I will have like the best piece of halibut going if I win this bet.
All right. Perfect. Yeah. Well, a nice piece of seafood for the other person.
Good.
Because
folks in Toronto that are Blue Jay fans would have no idea. They would never have had good seafood by now. I mean, heck, you could go to the Seattle baseball game and get Ivers, which is better than anything you can find in Toronto. So with that, I mean, we've almost done half the show. So
on baseball,
but it's a nice change for our listeners because I got pretty fired up.
And the show is sponsored by the NBA.
Oh, wow.
What a weird hockey podcast this is.
Yeah, Farhan. This is good. Hey, listen, let's dive into what's about to happen with the Canucks, because on September the 30th, we are a day away from the Canucks, from the NHL deadline to opt out. What is Travis Hamonic going to do? Is it done?
I don't think it's done. No, I don't think the club has a good indication of what's next, to be totally honest. And in asking around over the past day or two, you know, like there's a chance we'll have clarity this week and that the opt-out will solve the issue. I tend to think it's the most likely outcome. I know I've told you this already, Farhan, but I just think the other options are either remote or so unappealing that I really struggle to see the player going through with them. On the other hand, you know, there are sort of quiet options too, in terms of, you know, things like if the player was injured or, you know, anyway, there's a few other ways that this could play out. And so we may have clarity on Friday. I'm sure the club would love to. But they may not. This may be a problem that lingers beyond this week, unfortunately. So be prepared for that. And the other thing that I sort of got a sense of while I was asking around, and I was surprised to hear it, was, not surprised, but I just hadn't realized it, was, you know, you can't underrate how agonizing this type of situation is for the player, right? Like Jim Benning went off on the media poking their nose in to Ben Kuzma earlier this week. And while I think that was a little bit calculated, like while I think he was very happy to take an opportunity to defend, you know, a player with whom the organization would prefer to cooperate in terms of reaching a resolution over the next few days, I also think it was motivated in part by, you know, something that a couple of sources impressed upon me the other day, which is just that it's really tough. Like, it's been really tough on the player. And, you know, you or I might think it should be simple. Like, get dosed, play for your teammates, make money. But it's really not that straightforward for the person in the situation, like, agonizing about compromising what they see, you know, as their principles, selfishly and incorrectly. But nonetheless, that's their perception of it, right? And so while I suspect the opt-out is the cleanest way forward and the most likely, like, who knows? We should have a resolution by end of day Friday, but don't take that to the bank.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because when you consider what he went through 2 years ago to opt out, you'd think you'd want to keep every form of protection possible. What are the factors that Hamonic's considering here?
In terms of the, yeah, I mean,
and not just
I don't
from
know.
A, from
I don't
a what
insight.
Happens if you don't play, but it just seems so, it seems like such a no-brainer given what he's dealing with health-wise. It just seems like there's another layer to this that we're not quite understanding.
There is, for sure. And I don't understand it, so I won't speculate on it.
Sure.
But it does seem, you know, it's surprising. Well, and I don't think there's any question that considering the opt-out, right? And considering the way that last season played out, with the Canucks and their COVID outbreak and the players' reaction to it and some of the anger within the locker room from veteran players directed toward Adam Gaudette, for example, right?
Yep.
Patient zero of the outbreak. I do think the club didn't see this coming either, obviously, when they signed him to the two-year deal this summer. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very strange one.
Yeah, no doubt. And now from the Canucks' perspective, they're looking at what's next. And before we talk about how this might impact Hughes and Pettersson, and you hope those situations are coming to a head fairly quickly, but what about how they replace a guy like that? I mean, it's not as simple as moving Luke Shen up, is it? I mean, I know that we talked about this from a financial perspective earlier, and it seemed that that was the thing that made sense. Or that if had they done that this offseason, financially, they'd be in a better place given the actual difference between those two players. But the depth Luke Shen provides as right D number four, you also then have to replace that. So where do you look?
Well, I also think you're looking at Hamonic as a top four guy. Like, this team had him slotted probably top pair right D.
Sure.
I don't think you want to put Shen there. You know, like, Hamonic might not be much better than Shen, but in terms of the club's plans, like, he looms a lot larger. Shen is no replacement for him. And so, you know, I do think that's a tricky one. And also, I do think why, in the event that Hamonic was to change his mind here and just show up, you know, not that it wouldn't be a little complicated because of how the last 10 days have unfolded, but you know, club would love to have him. Like, make no mistake. And if they don't have him, they are going to have to replace him, and it isn't going to be simple. There may be some trade route options that you could find, especially once that money's freed up. But, you know, waiver wire, for sure. I would expect the Canucks to take a long, hard look. And not just expect. Like, the Canucks will take a long, hard look at defensive-minded right shot defenders that hit waivers between now and, you know, Tuesday, October 12th.
But could there possibly be anybody available in that situation that's any better than Luke Shen?
Maybe. I mean, there's some guys that could be if you give them opportunity and they hit. I mean, the model for this is Gustav Forsling, right? Who yeah. The Florida Panthers claimed off waivers. And he became a top four mainstay for them, ended up playing top pair for them with Mackenzie Weegar in the playoffs. And, you know, he's a high-risk guy. Like, I don't think he's a true talent top pair defenseman. You know, he's a 4 or 5, probably. But he's a good 4. Yeah, I mean, especially to get him off waivers, a free bet, as good as it gets. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I see that guy, but that's also the trick. No one sees Gustav Forsling as Gustav Forsling until he's Gustav Forsling. That's why he's on waivers. So there's some interesting bets that could emerge. There's some veteran D who are, you know, mobile, defense first. A guy like Chad Ruedel out of Pittsburgh, maybe if they decide to protect Friedman. So we'll see. Like, there's going to be some options, but they're not slam dunk, like clear Hamonic replacements. They're, you know, bets you have to place with some long shot odds on.
On some levels, though, that's what Hamonic was when you consider the circumstances that brought him to Vancouver a year ago to begin with, right? I mean, he's not necessarily who we view as a top pair defenseman. He just happens to fit with Quinn Hughes.
Yeah. And that's the other part here is if you bump Shen up, I don't think you're going to play him in the top four. I don't think they're going to play Myers with Quinn Hughes.
No.
We know they want to play Ekman-Larsson with Poolman. But if you lose Hamonic and you don't want to play Myers with Hughes, you kind of have to go Hughes-Poolman, Ekman-Larsson-Myers. And now you're playing Myers in shutdown minutes, which no one wants to see. So
could you play Shen with Ekman-Larsson?
I don't think so. Who's going to skate?
Yeah, like, well, fair enough.
There's not enough mobility there. So, yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a tough fit, a really tough fit. And I do think you do kind of need to find, like, a right defender that you're comfortable either playing in matchup minutes with Ekman-Larsson or being the Hughes caddy. And boy, I don't think that's an easy piece to find on the waiver wire and may necessitate, you know, a deal of some kind.
Well, we'll see how good their pro scout departing is, or department is, I should say, in the next week or so here, because who would have thought we would have been in this situation this close to the season where, despite two young stars not being with contracts, we're more concerned with a guy that's potentially a bottom pair defenseman that's playing in your top pair, and neither one of them are here right now.
Yeah. Well, and seems to me to be a bit of a holding pattern. You know, both sides, I think, at this point in the process, and this is based on what I'm hearing around the industry, conversations with people close to the situation, you know, both sides believe they've gone as far as they can here. Like, they've given. And so you get to this point where there remains a gulf, like a fundamental valuation disagreement. And anytime there's been progress on it, it changes what works for the other player, right? Sure. Like, which complicates things too. So I know the sides plan to touch base again a bit later today. And that while it's not close, like, it's not far either. You know, like, it's one of those things where it can just change with a phone call. So, you know, be a little bit careful reading too much into people saying they're far apart. There's a gulf, there's a valuation disagreement, and it's going to take one side to make the first move to close that gap. And so far, neither has blinked. But we're also probably another week to 10 days out from white knuckle territory in terms of being really concerned. And we'll sort of see how this standoff ends. But I won't be stunned if a deal gets done quick. And I won't be stunned if it drags on for another 10 days. Where I will start to be surprised, I think, is if it looks like the Canucks might really start the season without either player, you know, not just in the lineup on opening night, but like around the team with their deals done.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
A guy that's stressing right now and might need to make that call is Travis Green. Because you heard him yesterday saying, we'll worry about those guys when they get here, if they get here. And you know that Travis parses every word. That wasn't said just because. It wasn't a flippant comment.
No. You're right. It wasn't. Yeah, I liked it.
But who's he sending the message to? Those players, his team, or management?
I think everybody. He's like, guys, figure it out. That would be my read on it.
Does he really think there's a chance?
That they miss time?
That they miss actual games.
No, but if you think about who's the... Like, sorry, he might. But think about it this way. Who's the guy that has to be prepared for it? It's him.
Yeah, it gets dumped in his lap.
No matter what else goes down, no matter who's signed and who's in the lineup, you know, on game one, on October 13th, there's going to be reaction shots of him behind the bench, you know, grimacing at his team's performance with or without his best players. So, you know, he's probably the guy, other than maybe like a couple of the front office folks in the Canucks organization who like deal with like cap mechanics that are most focused on the possibility that they might not be here.
Yeah, and how much is the Hamonic situation? Because I think there's two schools of thought in terms of how this actually impacts that deal, that some believe that Pat Brisson and the players are waiting for that to happen. I mean, I'm sure the players aren't literally waiting. Quinn Hughes would probably love to have Hamonic playing with him rather than profiting off his absence financially. But I think there are two schools of thoughts here. There's a simplistic version that feels once they go, there's $3 million now available. But you've also got to replace that player. And there'll probably be some debate on the part of their representatives and how much should be spent to replace that player versus what should be given. And there's others who simply believe that the organization doesn't want to pay more, that they've got things slotted based on a per term situation, that this is what we'll pay based on this many years and so on, and not give that money completely, $1.5 million to each player on whatever term the owner or the agent chooses.
Well, if you're the team, you have to be saying that as you wait for the outcome, right? So we'll see. I mean, there's no question that once you open up that $3 million, like, I don't think it's immediately $1.5 for you, $1.5 for you, let's get these done. You know, like, that would look like an overpayment from the team perspective. That's not how this ends. But does that extra $3 million create some of the like lubrication, like problem solving lubrication you need to bridge the gap that remains between these two sides that are, you know, having a staring contest and an impasse? I think that's possible.
Wow. You know, and from an organizational perspective, you talk about what they value this at, but also the look associated and how it affects your internal salary cap. Like, if you're Jim Benning, how difficult is this? Because if you wind up paying more based on Hamonic leaving and you don't have that, I don't want to call it an excuse, but essentially it is that we just don't have the money to give you. How tough is that in the eyes of ownership, in the eyes of your long-term cap perspective, all of it? Like, this is a big loss for Jim Benning if he has to go this way.
Well, I just get a good outcome. You know, just get a good outcome. Like, the fact is that these guys should have been signed 12 months ago, right? Like, these contracts will dictate a decade worth of history for the Vancouver Canucks. Like, this will shape not just this season, but the medium and long-term future of this franchise.
But you don't overpay for that, do you?
I mean, it's not about overpaying for it so much as it's having certainty. Right? And, like, this is the one part of where this situation's at, too, that I think is reflective of what the club endured after leaving the bubble with the misery that was 2021 and the abrupt change in direction in terms of what the club could spend and what the priorities were. And, you know, you sign guys, young guys, after success in the bubble, right? And it's like they're eager to be part of something. You get a better contract outcome in that situation. But you cut costs, you spend a season not giving a flying F about winning, you know, and you have this COVID outbreak. You lose all the veteran players that they respect on and on down the line. And now you get to a point where, you know, you've improved your team, but you're out of money for them. Well, you know.
Yeah, you're right. But what you're telling me is that they basically are in the same situation they were in 3 and 4 years ago when they were giving ridiculous term to players who had no business getting four-year contracts, but they knew they had to do that because that's where they were as an organization and had to overpay or overterm in order to get even the most fringe player to consider coming to Vancouver. And now you're saying they're essentially having to do the same for their own guys.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that's a factor here. I really do. And that's unfortunate. Like, that should be upsetting for Canucks fans. But the bill comes due, whether or not you're pinching pennies or not, the bill comes due. And I do think, you know, one of the factors here is that it has. So, yeah, I mean, that's not to say that the Canucks won't, you know, hold steady here and get a good outcome. But, you know, I do think the lack of prioritization in terms of these deals not being done, the finite cap space left on the table, you know, the fringe historic level of performance that both of these players hit over their entry-level deals, combined, however, with the fact that the club didn't perform well, and neither did they, in their platform seasons. You know, all of that makes this pretty complicated and has created a gap in valuation between player and organization, a gap that for now, you know, remains in the space between which Pat Brisson and CAA and Jim Benning and the Canucks are still having a staring contest.
Well, if the thought was that once camp began, the player would then shift on the organize, or the pressure, I should say, would shift on the organization to get this done. The second Travis Hamonic opts out, if in fact that does happen and that cash is available, that pressure is going to ratchet up that much more. But
the Hamonic situation has kind of reduced the pressure on the organization, because it's given the market something else to speculate and obsess over. And, you know, like in some ways, you know, maybe the uncertainty has caused talks to drag a bit. Maybe. I don't think that's true, but it's possible.
But from a fan perspective, once it happens, there's no other dominoes left to fall. You have more money, you have to get it done.
Don't you think from a local perspective, the Hamonic story has just overshadowed
the last, since camp began, yes, it has. Yeah. And I know that Benning was critical in Kuz's column, but it's completely ridiculous and naive for him to think that we wouldn't pry and want to report on this story, given the fact that it was Benning himself that said, Hamonic is here and we will be 100% vaccinated. That was in the same press conference, seconds apart. Like, there was a report earlier that day before Benning spoke that Hamonic did not plan to take part, whether that day or whatever the situation would be or the timeline would be. He said he's here, basically shrugged and implied, I don't know what you're talking about, everything's fine. And then he doesn't show up to practice. For him to say that, what are you prying for? Are you kidding? You set us up for that. When you want context in terms of how we as a media dealt with the COVID crisis this team dealt with last year, we could not have been more respectful of the player's health, the privacy, and all of it. We could not have handled it more respectfully than we did collectively in terms of how we talked about names, who was dealing with what, all of it. So this is on him in terms of why we're getting involved. And you're right. As a result of his comments day one, instead of a lack of transparency, it has taken over the story. It has overshadowed those two young players.
Well, yeah. And the lack of transparency side of this is where it's cogent for me in terms of, you know, even with the COVID outbreak, they then barred media from like three practices, including ones that were happening like 24 hours out from a nationally broadcast game. That's ridiculous. There's no justification for that. The other side of this, though, for me anyway, is that, you know, I think this is such a fluid situation. Like, we reported, Dolly Wall and I, on the Monday before Jim spoke on Wednesday to open camp, that something had moved and that the Canucks were confident that they'd be able to say, we will be 100% vaccinated by the start of the regular season on Wednesday. They then did that, despite Irfan Ghaffar's report. And I think something changed. I think this has been that agonizing for the player that things have waffled. And so, you know, that brings us to where we are. The lack of transparency thing I buy, like, even the framing that this is a personal matter, considering everything this market knows and all the sympathy that it has for Hamonic's family situation, you know, feels manipulative to me, right? Like, there is something I don't like about that. I have a distaste for that, especially when it's seized on by the worst actors to be like, the media is speculating, lying, like, oh. But all of that said, you know, I take your point. I see it. I agree to some extent. But I also have some sympathy for the club, considering the way that the situation has unfolded as a saga, and the fact that at the moment anyway, you know, I took Benning's comments to Kuz with a heaping grain of salt, because I just think he was very happy to be seen defending a player's honor in this circumstance, especially as the club awaits and is to some extent at the mercy of his decision on how to move forward.
Let's get into the rest of the roster and some of what Travis said while we still got a bit of time here. And he talked about the fact that this is going to be a much more veteran roster. We saw 21 skaters and two goaltenders in practice, got our first look at the power play. But, you know, there weren't a lot of questions, right? There were a few in terms of the players that we saw, but by and large, okay, we didn't see Jonah Gadjevich. We didn't see Will Lockwood. We didn't see Klimovich. But there weren't any huge names that we fully expected unless they wanted to expand from that 21 number, but they needed enough in that B group to skate as well. But from Travis Green's perspective, we're not sitting at 21. We're actually sitting at 27 because there's six players that aren't here. So this is probably where I should be, and it gives me a better chance to look at some of these other guys in a more deeper, meaningful way. Fair?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think the way that he has to be thinking about it, though, is like, if no one shows up, right? If they are here, right? If no one shows up, what do I do? And I think this is like a first draft of the 23 man in the event that the six absent players, none of them return. Now, we know Justin Bailey will return. I don't think we know about the other five. So, you know, I read a lot into the players that were included, and I think you can. And I think there's a ton of really fascinating takeaways. Like, Phil DiGiuseppe in the top nine, clearly he's separated himself. I don't think Travis is making any secret of that at this point either in his comments to the media. Although it is obvious if you've been paying attention to the performances and scrimmages and practice. Olli Olevi with Kyle Burrows, pretty clearly the third man in that three-horse race, right? Like, they're not being polite about it at this point. It's explicit. And, you know, I don't think Rathbone's necessarily got that spot locked down ahead of Brad Hunt yet. I know people really want him to, but, you know, if Quinn Hughes returns, I won't be surprised by a Hunt-Myers third pair. Like, I really won't. And we'll see how Hunt performs here, but I think they're going to give both guys an equal shot. And it's pretty clear to me that they're set up to do so, based on the way they ran the power play, you know, based on the fact that both are playing with pretty veteran guys, like guys we expect to be in the lineup at this point. And then I do think that Lockwood and Gadjevich and the like are a tier below. Like, I think they're likely to be on the outside looking in based on their non-inclusion in that main group on Wednesday. So I think there was a fair bit of grist, like a fair bit of meat on that bone that we might chew. And, you know, I chewed at length in an article at The Athletic yesterday, and I think quite rightly. Like, I think the team showed us a lot about how they're thinking about this group and the pecking order on Wednesday.
Did you see enough from Dowling to separate him from those other three forwards that we've just mentioned?
Yeah, I think so. Especially because he's a center, and they're going to need him to kill penalties. Like, I think that penalty-killing utility is going to fundamentally shape the depth players that the club includes, especially on that fourth-line role. It's like, it's not only why I think Dowling has an edge over Gadjevich and Lockwood, but also because he can play center and kill penalties. I think he has an edge over Nick Petan, who, you know, has been playing with, like, top players all throughout camp. So, you know, we'll see where this ends up. But yeah, I mean, I think Dowling has shown pretty well. I think Dowling's shown better than the likes of Highmore and Chason and McEwen, you know, three guys who I sort of have circled as players that, you know, I probably wouldn't have given the inside track to over Gadjevich, based purely on merit-based performance that we've seen over the course of the past week.
So again, it was our first chance to look at the special teams yesterday, and you asked Travis about penalty kill deployment and how that'll factor in, especially as it relates to defensemen on the left side and right side and how comfortable he is there. So I'll take you through
it.
And his answer was, no, I know, but your answer was so long, you pretty much answered it. He just didn't acknowledge it. The question, it was perfect. You set it up right there. He looked at you. He gave you the look. He just didn't want to admit it. But
yeah,
we'll go through the forward pairs that we saw and the defense pairs yesterday in practice. The three forward pairs, Dickinson, DiGiuseppe, Dowling, and Highmore, to your point about his penalty kill utility. Podkolzin, which we know he can do that and has done that at different levels, but interesting to see he, along with McEwen, getting a look there at this stage of his career.
He won't kill penalties.
He won't.
Like, Green was pretty explicit about it.
Yeah. And then defensively, you've got Myers with Burrows and Yul Levy rotating in there, and then Shen and Poolman. And so you've got all your right side D populating your defensive pairs in the PK because, as you talked about earlier, there just aren't enough guys that can do that.
Yeah. Although OEL will jump in, right? Yeah. Like, OEL will be one of the lefty penalty killers. And then it looks like one of Myers or Shen will play their offside. And they'll flesh it out with the other two righties. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, it makes sense to me that you're going to go something like OEL and Shen or Poolman as your first, first option when the PK shift starts. And then Myers and the other one of Poolman or Shen, when as a secondary, like when they change. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's basically set unless they add an RD.
I remember last year when there were times when it seemed like Alex Edler never got off on a given PK. Could you imagine that happening to OEL
this year? Yeah, it's going to be OEL for sure.
Wow. And that will affect other aspects of his game, playing those hard minutes.
Totally will. And might lead to some, certainly heightens the injury risk, right? So, yeah, no, it's not ideal, man. And I think when you look up and down and look at this club's penalty killing options and then look at what it causes in terms of how the club has to build their fourth line, I don't think it's unfair to say that it's a roster construction issue, like one that will have to be patched over. They just don't have that, like, veteran 2 or 3 C. I mean, they have Dickinson. So it's really that, Horvat can't kill for some reason. I don't know why, but it just has never worked for him. And they don't really have that, like, 30-point two-way winger who's a PK ace. Like, a lot of teams have that guy, and the Canucks just don't. So, that sort of leaves the burden on the bottom end of your roster and changes what you're able to do with your fourth line. Like, I do think it's a big reason why guys like Gajewicz and Lockwood faced a pretty significant uphill climb. And despite showing as well as they could have, I think, have ended up outside the main group.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Gajewicz, as much as fans in this market are clamoring for the Mariners to get into the playoffs, they're also clamoring for Jonah Gajewicz to get some run with this team. They wanted to see it last year. We've seen a player that's improved his skating, that's taken a bit of a step. We talked about it after the last exhibition game, but you said at the time that the gap is just too big. What does he need to do to get some run, or at this stage, is it just a case of someone's going to need to get hurt to give him an opportunity?
I think Well, the bigger concern from my view is, does his profile entice one of those rebuilding teams like a Buffalo or a Detroit to hazard a waiver claim and see what he's got? Because when you look at the profile, he's 22, he'll be 23 in October, World Juniors, played for Canada, second round pick, big AHL counting stats last year. Just transformed his body and significantly addressed the weakest part of his game in terms of his speed. I mean, that's a pretty intriguing profile. Like, you don't get a lot of chances to get a player like that for free, necessarily. So, my concern, I guess, is does he get a chance to play with real top nine caliber line mates before being risked on waivers? Because I think he's got him. He's performed well enough, and the club just has to see it. But I don't know that they will. Like, I don't know where they're at with it in terms of, I think he'll get a game, but I don't know that he'll get a game in the top nine. And I think that would be an error.
Yeah, I tend to as well. And look, I wasn't necessarily loath to what happened with Cole Lynn. You know, I think they gave him enough run and there just wasn't a lot there. And in this case, I just don't think they did because of their concerns, which the coach admitted, yeah, he seems to have addressed this offseason. So you hate to lose that type of package when he can be such a useful player if he gets the opportunity and is able to take advantage of it. So I think he set himself up to have that opportunity to be the next guy, to not necessarily put the coaches in a situation where they're completely panicking at the thought of playing him.
To your point, though, Farhan, from last podcast, remember, like, we're looking for reasons to be optimistic about Pod Colson, right? How much hype would there be in this market right now if Pod Colson had had the training camp and preseason debut that Gadjevich did?
Oh, my God.
Right? Like, can you imagine? Market would be losing it. You know, for me, there's a lot of players that were in that main group. Like, at least four that I think Gadjevich has pretty handily outperformed over the course of camp and in the preseason. And, you know, he's done it at the bottom end of the lineup. He's done it in scrimmage matchups that are mostly AHL guys. So I'm not saying that the Canucks are even wrong to be harboring some skepticism or having him behind some guys who maybe have more PK utility or NHL experience or what have you. But I do want to see what can he do against like real NHL competition in a preseason game with some real NHL caliber line mates. And I do think he's at least played well enough to earn that. And I think he's a big enough waiver risk, which, you know, less than 50%. Like, I'm not saying he's likely to get claimed or a slam dunk, but he's a big enough waiver risk and he's performed well enough that I think you have to see it. And I think it would be, I won't say something as hard as malpractice, but suboptimal. It would be suboptimal if they declined to take that opportunity.
Yeah, I agree with you. And before we go, I want to ask you quickly about Brandon Sutter. Like, that's the one situation that's gone so under the radar. We know that Tyler Motte is here. It's just a case of time, and he won't start the regular season, but they've given us an indication. Justin Bailey should be here any day now after testing positive for COVID and having to stay in Buffalo a little bit longer. But in the case of Brandon Sutter, they're saying nothing beyond fatigue. Now, we're not in the regular season where you're not wanting to give up a competitive advantage while disclosing injuries. We're in the preseason here. I don't know if they think it affects them organizationally by not telling anybody what he's got. What's he got? What's going on here?
I don't know explicitly. Clearly, it's serious enough that he hasn't been seen. Like, he's not on the ice late either. You know, getting work in. There's something seriously up. And at this point, it doesn't feel likely that he's going to play to open the year, right?
It feels a lot like the Jonathan Toews situation a year ago in Chicago, where it was all fatigue-type symptoms and not much was being said. And, you know, that turned into a pretty significant thing for that year. Unfortunately, he's in a better place. But it just feels like that, and I'm not speculating on the injury, but just the cloak and dagger of it, and just saying it's just fatigue, you hope it's nothing like that.
At this point, it's hard to imagine it's not complicated, right? No, like, it's clearly complicated. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get to the bottom of it. Sutter himself, you know, pretty transparent guy. Like, I think he'll talk about this when he's ready. And when it's clear, my guess is that it's not even clear yet and that they're still working through that. So hopefully we'll get an update in the days ahead. But at this point, it's just hard to imagine him appearing suddenly, ramping up quickly and playing, you know, in less than 2 weeks. This feels like something where the Canucks are going to need to play a guy like Dowling or a guy like Highmore or, you know, Miller will stay at center. Like, they're going to need to address this in terms of, you know, finding guys to play in his stead.
And before I let you get on a rant about your thoughts on JT Miller at center, I think we better wrap up this episode of the VanCast. The next time we do this, I will have already gone to Boston and back and watched Tom Brady take on his former team. So that should be a lot of fun.
Oh, wow. That will be a lot of fun. I've got the Tampa Bay defense
and I'm facing Tom Brady this week in my fantasy matchup. So give me like snow. Like I want like a road.
Weather's going to be good in Boston.
I want a bad Tom Brady performance in a defensive slugfest in which the Bucs defense scores like three touchdowns off pick sixes.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out who's got the advantage in this one as far as Tom Brady knowing Bill Belichick better or Bill Belichick knowing Tom Brady better in terms of how to defend or attack one another.
Well, Tom Brady has won this divorce.
No question.
Right? Like by a lot. Yeah. Like Bill Belichick is, you know, like Milhouse's dad. Like he's trying to borrow a feeling from Tom Brady at this point. But
much like you won the Patterson divorce.
Yeah. yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think I've done very well in the Patterson divorce, to be totally honest with you. I mean, you're a trophy wife in comparison with Andrew Wadden.
That's fair. I'll give you that.
Yeah. The Brady Belichick thing, though, Brady has so clearly battered Belichick in the divorce that you just know that Belichick has more stakes on this.
And through all of that,
like the stakes are higher for him.
I'm not sure Belichick would have done it differently. And I'm not sure he was wrong in the decision he made, because who among us would have predicted that Tom Brady would have been even better at that age?
But I mean, come on. He's Tom Brady.
Still, we're saying that now after he won again. But the way he left that last game.
He microwaved a Super Bowl team the way you or I microwave a burrito. It's incredible. And you're right. I mean, Belichick might not have been wrong, and he would never admit that he was anyway. But it's nice to see. It's nice to see him, like, have to eat one. Like, genuinely, screw that guy.
Speaking of eating one, I'm really looking forward to eating my seafood. But before we go there, if you are interested in other podcasts at The Athletic, check out Joel Quenneville, the head coach of the Florida Panthers, who spoke with Ian Mendez and Haley Sullivan, or Salvin, I should say, this week on The Athletic Hockey Show. Marcus Foligno is Michael Russo's guest on this week's edition of Straight from the Source. And John Buccigross of ESPN joins Craig Custance and Sean Gentile on The Athletic Hockey Show USA this week at The Athletic. And once again, we would like to thank you for listening to the VanCast, which happened to be a baseball show for the first 10 or 12 minutes.
And then a football show for the last five.
There you go. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to leave a rating and review. Subscribe to The Athletic Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts to get all the bonus content from our entire network. Start with a 30-day free trial, then just 99 cents a month after that. And right now, annual subscriptions to The Athletic are 50% off when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. I'm going to have to look up seafood restaurants so I can make sure I pick the best. Best black and salmon, maybe.
Yeah, Blue Water Cafe. Like
nothing blue. Nothing blue is going to win this week. It's going to be the Mariners ahead of the Blue Jays at the end of the week. Book it.
No chance.
Book it.
It's going to be either Yankees, Red Sox, or Red Sox, Blue Jays. And that is what it is.
I am on the ABB train, anything but Blue Jays. And with that, thank you for listening. We will be back next week to break down the Tampa Bay game against New England. Oh, no, wait. Where the Canucks are at.
To break down the Mariners choking in the series against the Angels.
No chance. We're talking about Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson coming back to Vancouver. Clarity on the Travis Hamonic situation. That and more. Thanks for listening.